podcast with a kid.
Morning! It is for us anyway. Christian Corley here, and with me is James McLean. This is the podcast with a K, in which we talk about Doctor Who. Doctor Who. Yeah. And so there you go. And there's been quite a few things happening over the past few days in the Doctor Who worlds. The worlds of Doctor Who. It's not really one world, is it? For a start off, there are lots of planets that the Doctor can travel to. And for a second off, there does seem to be various continuities and realities within the Doctor Who universe, which different types of fans kind of occupy. I would be very surprised to know of anyone, single fan, who has enjoyed every single piece of Doctor Who media that has been produced.
Oh, you will get the ones who say it, just because they feel that gives them a hierarchy of power. And I've enjoyed it all, and you just really can't say, why do you watch it if you don't love it all? You know, you're not really a... I hate the term fan anyway. I think it's sort of... I know people say, well, you know, fan has now found its value, you know, it's now got some sort of coolness to it. And no, it hasn't. It's a horrible thing to be a fan. It sounds like a one-way street. It's... No. I want something that's more balanced.
What term do you prefer?
I just like to say I enjoy Doctor Who, I guess.
Okay.
Yep. So I think that's... I mean, you can enjoy something a lot. You can enjoy something a little. You can enjoy something to the point... There's levels of enjoyment, isn't there?
I think if we consider that fan is short for fanatic, then basically we're into sort of cultish territory.
I think that's why I don't like fanatic, because I'm not. I'm a fanatic. It's like football fanatic, I suppose they get the same sort of thing. And you think, and I some enjoy that. But again, it's like, well, I suppose, no, I don't like to think I'm a fanatic on it. Because no, I won't support it at every level.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There's one thing that
I'm
would
a critic.
Yeah, why not? There's one thing I would consider myself to be a fan of, that I am fanatical about, and that is breathing.
Yes. You know, I thought for a second you were perhaps going to say your children, but I'm kind of amused that you forgot about them and just went straight for the selfish breathing factor.
Well, no, I don't think you can be fanatical about children. You've got to be clear and level-headed, and that's something that fanaticism doesn't usually impart, or the term doesn't anyway, and probably doesn't. If you're fanatical about something, then you probably aren't clear and level-headed most of the time.
But don't aren't parents meant to die for their children? Isn't that the cinematic trope?
Yes.
So that's a fairly fanatical thing.
There is an aspect of it, but then at the same time, there's that kind of genetic hereditary towards it as well. So I suppose it's not entirely... I don't know. I've never given it too much thought.
No.
But anyway...
What is this thing you're talking about?
Cybermen!
Oh, yes.
Which I suppose is... We could get a tangential link to original Cybermen from wanting to protect dying for your children. Because, you know, as you know, the Cybermen developed their mechanical immortality through trying to avoid death.
Was this from the tanned genitals that you were talking about earlier? Is this what brought on the need to start lopping bits off them?
I don't think I said tanned genitals.
It did sound a bit like that. I'm sure the listener will be thinking, that's interesting. Well, how do you get tanned genitals?
If you're listening, Melania, we're not talking about you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, we've got the finale, I believe.
So Doctor Who Series 10 finale has Cybermen.
Which, incidentally, we should point out, BBC has pushed this out as press, so it's not like... Well, it's spoilers, but it's officially sanctioned spoilers. It's not...
Yeah. Now, what we've seen, 10th Planet Cybermen.
Yes.
Are we to assume that there are other Cybermen in there in an Asylum of the Daleks-style menagerie of Cybes, do you think?
Well, I'm not going to give you... I have heard from certain sources that maybe there may be more than the 10th Planet ones, that this is going to be an asylum for the Daleks.
Oh, God.
So, yes, I think, and I will say the source I heard from this was uttered similar, rejected sight of, oh, God, here we go again. And there's a good reason for doing this, I think, because there's a suggestion this season from what fans are extrapolating. You have one episode, which we've seen 5 minutes of last year, okay, 2 minutes, 30 seconds, which seems to marry as a prequel to The Power of the Daleks in 1966, and looks like it might be the same episode which carries the 1979 Mavellans, and sort of mashes those two together. Now, that's conjecture, but that would fit very similar to the opening two-parter for Series 9. So it doesn't feel like anyone's learned anything from last series.
No.
Lots of convoluted, if that is a right assumption, lots of convoluted back history stuff, which is perhaps where the show shouldn't be going.
Well, it's been there before.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like the class thing, isn't it, really? You know, Doctor Who has had spin-offs before, so it should be able to replicate their successes and failures and produce a better spin-off rather than arguably a worse one. And Doctor Who has been down the road of hanging itself on its own history.
Well, the history repeats itself, and that's what's so funny about it. Again, speaking as a Doctor Who critique rather than a fan, but if you look at, say, Destiny of the Daleks, where you have that line that was lampooned for years after, certainly through the 80s, where the Doctor sort of says, you know, if you're going to come and, if you're the masters of the universe, why don't you try and follow me, alluding to the fact they can't get up into the hole he's in because mm-hmm. they are stuck to the ground, sort of noting their weaknesses to the audience. An enemy which was now you know coming up to 15 years old, and that's quite was 15 years old. That's quite a dangerous thing to do because you're undermining it, and then you have this click with Bill and the Daleks last year where she's essentially doing the same thing. She's mocking the Daleks to a point where you don't want to do that because they're over 10 years old now. For new fans, you don't want to be distilling them into some sort of pop memento.
Strax. I feel there's the same for the Cybermen.
Yes.
Comedy Sontarans.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That's the problem. And it can be great, and it makes it easy writing in the sense that you just let the colour and the excitement just come from witty dialogue. But ultimately, by doing that, and by being also postmodern and meta, you ultimately start to devalue the things in the... I mean, the Daleks are meant to be, whether how silly they look and how many times you've seen them in the show, they're meant to be, you know, fascist, Nazi, eugenics, whatever you want to call them. They're a horrific force which annihilates everything. Mm. That is terrible. They'll annihilate your children. They'll nuke cities. They're absolutely crazily horrible creatures. So as soon as you get your side character just mocking them, yeah, it can be funny in that sort of way that we know that they are just silly, you know, oddly designed things with actors on with slippers in them, you know. But as soon as you do that, you're weakening your story. And that's what he does all the time. And I think that is the concern with the Cybermen. Yeah. And the colleague I spoke to was saying, you know, his worry is that you're going to have Missy sort of laughing at the 10th Cybermen voices and things like that. It's like, oh, that is when that's when you're abusing your show. Because in that continuity, that should be scary, not funny. Okay, it might be funny for audiences, but referencing that within the show sides you with the audience rather than the material. It's almost like you can't believe in the material, or you're worried that the people watching it can't, so I'm going to side with them. It's almost like the bully. It's like the guy in the playground who sees the bully but, you know, knows he's bad, but can't. But because it's safer to side with the bully, sort of sits with him behind and sort of laughs at the people the bully's, beating up because it's safer. And it's that sort of thing. And, yeah, a lot of conjecture there, obviously. It could be.
Yeah, great. Sure. Have you read the press release?
I haven't. Please read.
This is the press release. Headline, original Mondasian Cybermen return to Doctor Who. The original Mondasian Cybermen return to Doctor Who as filming begins on the final block of the forthcoming series. Filming has begun on the final two episodes of Doctor Who Series 10, with its first look image revealing the return of a much-feared classic foe. The Doctor, Peter Capaldi, is pictured with the Mondasian Cybermen, the original version of the Doctor's deadly enemies, who hail from the planet Mondas and have not been seen in Doctor Who for over 50 years. The Mondasian Cybermen, Peter Capaldi's longtime favourite foe, will return in episodes 11 and 12 of the series, etc. Now, I don't know if you were counting there. That is four mentions of Mondasian Cybermen. I just want to refer you to the Twitter feed of one Gareth Roberts.
Yeah.
Quote, Mondasian in a press release for normal people.
Yeah. That, again, it just shows where the show just seems to be really still spinning with no idea where it needs to be landing. And I wonder who wrote that press. It sounds like something that's probably come from production.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Production pushing for the Mondasian? Is that to try and do they feel that new audiences know that they're, I mean, it could be in fairness. There could be an argument that they're wary the design is so radical for new audiences that they're trying to sort of delineate that these are different Cybermen. So they're hoping the Mondasian for new audiences suggests that these are sort of a localized Cybermen and not quite the same Cybermen that you knew. I don't know. That is a really weird press release. Hmm.
At the moment, it feels like Doctor Who, from the PR side of things, is kind of mishit after mishit.
Yes.
Whether it's clips or press releases, there does seem to be a lack of focus there that wasn't there, certainly wasn't there during the RTD era, and with the exception of maybe the specials and Planet of the Dead, and wasn't there in the early Moffat era. Everything was very carefully orchestrated through 2010 to 2012.
But then you've got the point with the Moffat era, the early Moffat era, is even though it's a new, well, it's not a totally new production team. There will be a sort of transitional sort of flavour of how things slowly be lost as time goes on. I mean, I think one of the things which Doctor Who seems to have lost, which maybe I thought was very clever with the Russell T Davies era, was that whole, now my brain's going, what, Russell transmitted diseases? That's interesting. Was the whole thing with the web add-ons, you know, there's these very small sort of cheap scenes and websites. And there's a lot of sort of this sort of paratextual stuff that was connected to Doctor Who, which sort of made it feel a little more in control, like there was a specific marketing plan, you had the unit websites.
Yeah.
It felt like it knew its audience by that as well, that it was aiming at kids and young people, but not in a silly way, in a way that was trying to make you believe in this. You know, these things are real, these things are happening. You can go to the unit website. You can follow Mickey
on Mickey's blog or have a look at Clive's website or whatever. Yeah.
And these are sort of quite cheap ways of organising promotional material.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can knock up a, I mean, those weren't professionals, not the right word. Those weren't ornate or elaborate websites in any sense of the word. I mean, the first three or four, they were just static HTML.
Yeah.
So they could have been knocked up in a day with a good design plan behind them. You know, they could have been created in a day and then just published and, you know, that's it. I said, and it's a memorable piece of, associated material because everyone still remembers them.
And you can even tack on, and again, I know this is a very presumptuous thing to say, but if you planned it ahead, you could drop in very tiny web episodes again, you know, 2 minutes that you film at the beginning of, which they were doing in Moffat's era as well, as I recall. You know,
yeah,
2 minutes that was filmed at the beginning of your story, which you would then just segment out and make sure you've got the rights to release that as well as episodes. You know, there's ways around this, which feels like this, like the show is screaming for that reboot. It screams for that soft reboot where it can just refind itself.
Yeah. The other thing as well, which while we're talking about this sort of like whole, and I don't want to get into ratings or anything, but this whole kind of perception of Doctor Who publicly, is that, as we understand, it's going to be on after 8 o'clock.
Is it what? This season.
This season, yeah.
Series, yeah.
That's later than the last series.
But they still see this series, and again, you know, I don't want to say things like the show is betraying its roots or anything silly like that, but the series for the last few years feels like it's very uncomfortable acknowledging its young audiences.
Yeah.
And so it seems that, oh, well, they'll say, well, scheduling's been bad and they put us on at the wrong times. But if your show's not geared or showing evidence that it's geared for young audiences, is that a surprise that it's going to be moved later? It just feels pitched at the wrong audience.
Well, see,
And
if
like,
you consider who was in charge of Doctor Who from 2005 to 2010,
yeah.
and what he had been doing beforehand, and then look at who's in charge now and what he had been doing beforehand, it really, I mean, it's not really an immense surprise that it should perhaps drift in that direction, I suppose.
I mean, there was stuff that I mean, Moffat's done stuff on the kids' side before as well.
Well, I
You
can
know,
only think of Press Gang,
well, I was only thinking
and that
Press
was
Gang.
like nearly 30 years ago, wasn't
True,
it? So,
true.
25 years ago.
All I'm saying is that both of them have a background in young audiences. So once you know that Doctor Who should be for younger audiences, then it should be hard to keep it that way. It kind of feels, though, obviously, is that to some degree, I think Stephen, being a very big fan, although Russell was as well, writes for himself to some degree what the sort of Doctor Who he would like to see, rather than maybe what audiences would like to
I think
see.
as well, just to be clear, we're not saying that Doctor Who is exclusively for younger audiences. We're saying that Doctor Who should be embracing younger audiences, and that younger audiences should be included in the entire experience of Doctor Who,
We just,
not sent to bed
well,
because it's 8 o'clock.
we've just done a podcast just recorded on the Flash Gordon, which again is a good example of this. Got some bits which are a little scary for kids, but is very open to be enjoyed by kids. It has a family movie feel to it. You can do that. You can make something which can, and we are actually, to be honest, we are in the era where that is now very much, you know, for the last 15 years, last, oh no, more than that, last 20 years since, you know, Pixar certainly. You've had this movement where meshing family audiences in a way where adults can enjoy it and kids can enjoy it has become a thing. And that's not where Doctor Who really sits anymore. For me, anyway. Not that I say I have no kids, so it's not like I particularly
Well,
want
no, I mean,
kids.
I agree.
I
I mean,
feel that's where it should be.
I have nieces who came along before my children came along, and they're nowhere near as enthused about Doctor Who now as they were when Matt Smith was a doctor. No disrespect to Peter Capaldi, I'm sure, because those shows were tonally different to what we're getting now, and David Tennant before that. When I watched Doctor Who with Bruce, I can. 9 times out of 10, I can pick an Eccleston or Tennant episode and put it on, and as long as I'm with him or there's an adult with him to watch it, he's going to be okay. Some of the more recent ones, they kind of need reviewing in advance, which in my mind, so that's a little bit inconvenient, and it does say we've moved away from 5-year-olds. Doctor Who now is for 12, 13, 14-year-olds, which. It's been there before, but I don't think it's, the time slot has never been so divisive, isn't it? It hasn't sort of demarked that territory of audience as it appears it's going to this year.
It kind of feels like it's even older than that, in the grounds that it's so often you get this reference to Doctor Who's past, which to enjoy, you either got to be someone who has enjoyed it as catching up with archives as a young adult through DVDs and the like, or you're aiming it largely at people who remember that sort of stuff. Even down to, you know, Gallifrey at the end of last season, although to be fair, since Gallifrey's been in new series as well, that isn't such an old concept anymore. So you could argue that, I suppose, to be fair. But, you know, the things like, you know, again, the Davros storyline, which was very much geared that you had to really, you didn't have to, but you enjoyed it the most if you knew about Genesis of the Daleks, if you understood the conversation that sort of span the story out. That's where you get the meaning from it. And that, to me, seems like you're aiming at not even at 14, 15, 16-year-olds. You're aiming it at 40-year-olds or even 50-year-olds, 40 to 50-year-olds. And it's like, no, it's not where it should be. That's not. So it's going to be interesting to see where they take it when Chibnall takes over, whether he'll keep the companion, whether the companion is just for one season, whether that he'll just try and start again, and whether he'll just go, whether it will just be a start again from RTD. Will he just go back and do that? Or will he even try and change that to some degree, which it does feel like it needs changing.
Now
We've talked about this before, like the
something,
Rose archetype, that needs to change. things like that. So yeah, it just doesn't feel like he can just go back to 2005 and just make it a little more kid-friendly, character-focused. I think it needs a little more than that. It needs a little more freshening up. So yeah, it's a kind of a shame, because I saw the Cybermen, I was like, oh, that's unusual, and that could be really nice for Capaldi, since he's, you know, a long-time Doctor Who fan, but if it's written wrong, that's going to be a real shame for Capaldi and those monsters.
Well, also, as well, I mean, those are really, you know, these are cadavers in plastic holding them together.
Yeah.
Mechanised, you know, like being animated by machinery. And throwing them in with, you know, your flight suit Cybermen and your cyber Cybermen and everything, and your ultra powerful Iron Man Cybermen of 2013. If you're throwing in with them, then not only does that devalue them that way, it completely ignores the abject horror of what those creatures are in there, which is that screams massive storytelling opportunity.
Well, this is it. Because sometimes it's like reading an essay, and you think you read an essay and you think, this is doing too much. It doesn't need to do all this. You can do a lot less and make it more refined and more interesting. You know, and that's what it kind of feels like. You know, even if you've got two episodes, you're still talking about 2 hours max, if both episodes are an hour, which they won't be. And you have now got a load of Cybermen, and as you say, all Cybermen are sort of slightly different characteristics to their era. On top of that, if Missy's in it as well, which is rumoured. I'm not saying that's for sure, but you know, if Missy's in there as well, that's a lot of people being juggled, and I imagine that will all link to a long-term story arc, which will have been sort of seeded again through the series. So you don't need all that, you know. If you just focused on the, I mean, it could be. I mean, I was never a massive fan of was it Cold War, the Gatiss's Ice Warrior one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't a massive fan of that, but it worked in itself because it truncated itself down to just being about the one thing.
Yeah.
And that seemed, if nothing else, even if you didn't particularly enjoy it, it at least felt respectful to that monster. It was trying to make that monster relevant and relevant to its past and to the present. But it just kind of feels like as soon as you do the Asylum of the Daleks sort of thing, you do as you say, you lose that sort of power.
Well, I mean, we're only speculating at the moment, so you know, we wait until probably June time when we see it and find out, and then we can react correctly.
Well, this is it. I mean, we should be clear. I mean, this is all speculation. I mean, we know Missy's in the season. We know how he likes to build all his arcs up. I mean, she might not be in it. It may be that the Tenth Planet ones are the focus, and the other Cybermen, if they are there, are in the background like Asylum. Because Asylum did that, and so did the opener of the debut for last season, didn't it? There's lots of Daleks there, but it was still focused on Devros. So
yeah. It
may be that there's just a lot of set dressing, but the focus is the Mondasian ones. It could be that, or we could find out the focus is the normal Cybermen and the Mondasians are just in the background. Because there's a lot of the material for Asylum the Daleks sort of suggested that the old Daleks would have quite a big role in it, and they didn't.
No.
They were set dressing. So it could all just be set dressing, and it could all be focused, and it could all be great. But, you know, it's just trying to interpret the science, which is what we do as critics, isn't it? Not as fans, as critics.
Sure.
We look at what we're given, we make our assumptions, and then we wait to see if we're proved right or wrong. And that's the game. If we're proved wrong, that's good for everyone.
More speculation now, though, on the podcast with a K. Death in Paradise news. Now, if you weren't aware, Death in Paradise has it's been running for about 6 or 7 years now, and it originally started with Ben Miller, comedy actor Ben Miller, as the main character who travels to the Caribbean to investigate the murder of another English policeman. While he's there, he ends up staying there for 2 years. He then gets killed himself, and sent over in his place is Humphrey Goodman, played by Chris Marshall, who then stays for probably 4 years, I think. If we got our adding head on correctly.
Sally. Finished 5,
or and a half, or and a most of one. But whatever, yeah. And then he decided to leave and was replaced by Ardal O'Hanlon. So Chris Marshall has left the Caribbean. He's left Death in Paradise. And when Peter Capaldi's departure from Doctor Who was announced, there's a few eyebrows raised that these two things happened within sort of a week or two of each other. I think Chris Marshall's departure was leaked as well. It wasn't supposed to have been... I think it was in a kind of a non-sci-fi sort of way. I think it was supposed to be a sort of regeneration, a David Tennant regeneration moment. You know, an Eccleston to Tennant regeneration moment. It was supposed to come as a surprise. But as it turned out, it was leaked on the morning of the episode. So, you've got Chris Marshall left Doctor Who, then, left Death in Paradise, Peter Capaldi left Doctor Who. You've got people betting, as they tend to do, on who's going to be the new Doctor Who. And just this week, we hear that betting has been suspended on Chris Marshall being cast as Doctor Who due to a spike in bets. It's a shame our friend Gareth Cavanagh isn't here to talk about this, because he's a man who knows a thing or two about betting on Doctor Who actors. But I mean, do you feel this is likely? Is a betting thing? Is it a distraction?
Because the bookies were very favourable to female Doctor Who's a few weeks ago.
Mm.
And then suddenly now they've closed bets on a male Doctor Who. The two things which I think need to be considered, one is that, as you were just saying, which neatly timed, is that when Capaldi was being announced, Ben Miller finished in Death in Paradise.
Yes.
There was talk of whether Ben Miller would become the next Doctor because he had finished his role in Death in Paradise. And you have a similar setup and similar statements. I think Chris has finished because of family and missing England in the same way that Ben was. So, you know, is there just weird connections? At the same time, you know, shutting bets is quite a big thing, a bit of a risk. I could see Chris could fulfill the role. He has a sort of criteria I think they'd be looking for. He's not too young, but he's still got a young face. He's got a certain amount of visibility, but he's not overly stereotyped. He's played lead roles before, and Death in Paradise is a little quirky. And he would nicely juxtapose Capaldi.
There's something else as well.
Yeah?
Death in Paradise's audience has been increasing.
That's an interesting point.
It's higher now than it was when Ben Miller was in it, and there's very few shows that increase their audience over that period of time.
That's true. That's a very good point. So there's a lot of reasons why he fits the bill, and he's got the background and the status to do it. My only concern would be if they'd just let him be who he is rather than having to be like a Tom Baker, which is what sort of Matt Smith and Capaldi often ends up having to do, which doesn't feel like what Capaldi should be doing. You know, Chris Marshall's got quite a gentle character. It's more like Peter Davison.
Hmm.
Would they let him do that, or would they feel this need to just write him as the outlandish Tom Baker, which seems to be the way the Doctor has to be? And does he have to be? You know, Hartnell wasn't. Kirby wasn't.
Eccleston wasn't.
No, absolutely. I mean, Eccleston had moments, and I know they tried to write that into being sort of like sort of fakery to sort of make him look like he was a depressed character trying to be happy. But certainly you felt there was a difference in Eccleston to Tennant, Smith. So will they let... Because they didn't with Capaldi. Capaldi, as we've said before, you go to certain Capaldi episodes in Series 8, you can feel that Capaldi there. You can feel the Malcolm Tucker idea bubbling under. But by Series 9, it's gone. So would they let him, would they let Chris be that sort of person that I think Chris could be, or would they have him just spouting off silliness the whole time? Be a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, we know he's an actor who does comedy well. My Family, yeah, and we should also probably blame him for My Family as well, because I think he was the main reason for its early success, which led to it running well beyond its sell-by date after he'd left.
Well, he was a fairly absurd character in that.
Yes, he was, yeah.
But still quite a charming character. He wasn't an eccentric farce. Ironically, really, in a weird way, where Ardell has taken over Chris Marshall's role in Death in Paradise, Chris Marshall's role in My Family was a little bit of an Ardwell Dougal from Father Ted, slightly absurdly stupid, as I recall anyway. I wasn't a fan of My Family. But...
No, there's certainly that element to him, yeah.
So, Swings and Roundabouts. But yes, but I think it's interesting the bookies are now going there rather than the female, which seems to be they seem to be stepping back from that. Which seems sensible, as I've said before. I think if you're going to soft reboot a show and try and bring back to its glory days, inverted commas, you know, should you then go and cast a female, which is going to be highly controversial? You sort of only do that when you've got confidence in your show. If you want to take a risk like that, you don't do it when you're trying to re-establish yourself. So it seems more sensible that they're looking at a male and why the bookies might be a little nervous now.
And of course, there was a similar scenario with Capaldi as well when he was announced. He suddenly stepped into the frame quite late on, and then the bookies
had to shut down.
Suspended, yeah.
So that was like a day or so, wasn't it, before the announcement?
Yeah.
Have we been given announcement day? Because they talked about, haven't they, doing another sort of special show.
Oh, God, have they?
I'm sure I saw. I could be wrong. I'm sure I saw something.
Right, we'll do a live podcast that day then.
If they do that, but there's no announcement to when they're going to announce. I imagine they're not going to do that until either just before Doctor Who, so April, or after.
Hmm.
They're going to go for late, but I suspect they'll do it before because they know the news won't stay. Because they'll have to be looking at pre-production. By that point, it's going to be hard to hide. So I think we're going to probably hear something just before Doctor Who airs. So it's a way to build up interest.
Quite possibly. Ladbrokes Alex Donohoe said, a surge of punters have backed Marshall, so we've had no choice but to close the book. If he does get the gig, the bookies will be exterminated first. How droll.
It's interesting, isn't it? But it doesn't sound like the bookies are necessarily reacting to information. Reacting to the fear that it could be a likely one, and there's so many people who have actually placed bets down on an outsider.
I wonder who the people are who bet on Doctor Who.
We know
Gareth Gavanna does. They've got to be on the whole people who have got a very strong idea of who it's going to be. Otherwise, you wouldn't waste money on a bet, would you?
But isn't that the nature of betting? Isn't it taking the risk on something which is outside and thus? The windfall.
No, I've never understood it, to be honest with you. So,
no, it's it's an odd one. I think certainly it's not going to be. I think someone like Chris Marshall is the sort of name that seems believable to me.
Yeah,
seems the right level. I imagine the cost of Marshall is within their sort of remit. I think some of the other names have been. You get some quite big names. They're not going to be looking for someone. With a massive legacy and a massive fee. They're going to be looking for someone who's... I mean, Capaldi was, you know, big for the thick of it, but he wasn't like an established actor. But he wasn't like a massive, massive name.
Like Tennant.
Well, yeah, like Tennant as well. You know, they were just known for that one big thing, even though they'd done other things as well. And that always seems to be the sort of zone they're looking for now, which is a good zone. So, yeah, I'd be happy with Chris. I've not been a massive fan of him really at all. And I don't mean that in any rude way. It's not really touched me or anything. But at the same time, I could see him being quite a good choice.
What you're saying is you've never been obsessive about him.
No, I've never been obsessive about him. I've seen him, or critic. I've never been a critic about him particularly. No, I didn't really read into him. I never liked My Family, not because of the actors, just the writing style was just... It was just not a funny show for me. Strange enough, I never was particularly keen on adverts and his long run for...
BT, yeah.
So that never particularly warmed me to him invading my shows every year. And I've only seen a couple of episodes of Death in Paradise with him in, and he seemed okay. He seemed a little ineffectual, but that show doesn't really give that much for the lead to breathe into, apart from push the mystery on. The leads aren't that expensive.
Well, it's amazing how on that show they managed to keep it fresh, actually, given how long it's been going and how limited, really, the format is.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's limiting for the actor, I think, as well. You know, how do you breathe life into something where it's the aesthetic, and the mystery which drives it on. It's not really the lead. It's not like, you know, Father Brown, or I'm trying to think of shows where, you know, Touch of Frost, where it's about the lead character, Cracker. Mm. It's really about the setting and the murders within that setting. And so the lead doesn't have that much to play with. So it's really down to your own charm. And he does have his own sort of gentle charm about him. I could imagine kids watching it with Chris Marshall and going, yeah, I'd like to go into the TARDIS with him.
Mm.
You know, I'd like to travel with that character. And that's really what you want in your Doctor. You want someone that adults can enjoy, but kids would say, I'd love to have time and space adventures with that guy. I'd like to be his friend.
Do you think kids get that with Capaldi?
I think Capaldi could have brought something different to it. I think kids, as I think I've said before, if they'd never got him quite right, initially, I think he's better as a character. I think kids can find him funny, like Blackadder. I mean, you watch Blackadder, you wouldn't want to be Blackadder's friend. But you can sort of admire him because he's everything he shouldn't be. And Capaldi could have been that. And if they'd sort of done the dress down on him, instead of being so fixated and trying to sort of make him look like John Pertwee, and sort of done the hoodie and let his hair grow like they have done now, I think that mixture, that sort of tension between sort of young dress, older person, playing guitar, with a sort of really sort of dark edge, and let the two companions, because there should have been two, warm up, you know, play the nice, warm, charming role. You'd have kids going, yeah, I'd like to go into the TARDIS. So like Hartnell's era.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't want to go into the TARDIS with Hartnell. I'd want to go because I think Ian and Barbara are really nice. But Hartnell is cool in his own way. There's something quite fun about him. But it's that TARDIS family which makes you want to be there. And that's what they should have done with Capaldi. You know, as we've said before, we know we've talked about this, young action male, young female, Capaldi being the really sort of Blackaddery, unpredictable mixture of William Hartnell and Sylvester McCoy and Malcolm Tucker. That's what you needed. Mysterious, slightly crotchety, and quite a sort of sharp, young sense of humour, perhaps not always intended. And then let the two companions warm the audience and play this sort of warming role. And that would have made him work. They never did that. They just rolled him back into being sort of like an old version of Matt Smith, and he looked a bit daft for it. So yeah, so maybe Chris, I think Chris could appeal to the younger crowd. I think that would be quite interesting. It'd be really interesting. I know they won't do it. They had young Chris, fairly young Chris, and then had an older female or an older male actor in there. Even Matt Lucas, you know, kept him on.
Interesting.
Hey, I'm still having hopes that he'll be all right. I've got to have something to cling on to here.
Okay.
They're certainly not doing the right thing with Capaldi. So, and you, as I've said before, if you go and watch the old Series 8 ones, you know, really good ones, sort of, say, Time Heist, Mummy on the Audience Express, even Flatline, you see him as he should have been.
Yeah.
Flatline, they're starting to dilute him a bit by then. He's starting to do little bits of things which just don't feel quite right for him. Not much, but they're starting to fall into there in a way, starting to be diluted. But yeah, so the Flatline, I'm on the Orient Express, Deep Breath, Dalek, those are where you really see where that character's starting to emerge, and then he just disappears.
I was in YouTube the other day. I was on YouTube. I wasn't really on YouTube.
Were you in or were you watching it? I mean, you can be either with YouTube.
I was browsing YouTube, right. And I was looking at Doctor Who clips. And I suppose a portion of this is to do with the fans selecting clips and then uploading them or whatever. But also a bit of it comes from the BBC, some departments of uploading clips and stuff. And what I found was so many more great moment clips for Matt Smith than for Peter Capaldi. Yeah. And I had to think about it, and there's possibly a podcast in this anyway, a separate podcast in this. But it struck me that, actually, yeah, Peter Capaldi hasn't had that many great moments.
Well, what do you define as a great moment, just out of interest?
I would call a great moment something like when the 11th Doctor puts his bow tie on and walks through the holograms. Or the speech against the Weeping Angels.
So is it the speeches? I mean, are those? I mean,
Yeah,
I'm not
probably. Yeah,
excited
probably.
asking.
Yeah, I think probably speeches. Yeah, they don't have to be long speeches. They can be short speeches. But yeah, those speech moments. Yeah.
I mean, I think Capaldi had, like I say, if you go back to Series 8, his strengths, because he didn't have really any speeches, as you say, his strengths came in that sort of the way he was so anti-hero. Those little one-liners, which sort of suggested that, he really didn't care or that he was a very callous character. The fact that, the pragmatist was very interesting, where he would sort of say, person's dead, get over it, if you want to keep living, stay in the moment. There was those sort of things I thought were very powerful with him, but there just wasn't enough. And yeah, there certainly wasn't those moments where they could have written more angry speeches. They tried to do it in the Zygon one, where he has that sort of very long angry speech, and it sort of works. But they could have done that. I think maybe that was their mistake as well, and maybe because that is actually hard writing. To write, I'm trying to think of which character does. I'm trying to think of characters that do angry speeches where you're just waiting. I mean, House used to do them. You need, I'm trying to think of people who do those sort of angry diatribes where you're just waiting for them to turn around and just rattle off something which is, particularly, so it's different to Matt Smith's. Do you see what I mean? Where you have those moments where you think you say those standing moments where the doctor just, where you're waiting for the doctor to just turn around, just take control and just eulogise. But it's got to be done in a certain way that fits the character. And I didn't really see them with Capaldi. They weren't there, were they? The Zygon one is the nearest you get. But I think they could have done them better. I think they could have done them more in his character. The sort of thing that you'd see Michael Nkrumah do, just take out the swearing. Where he just turns around. Because there is that catharsis, isn't there, in television, where you have characters which are really irritating. You build them up to be irritating, then you have a character turn around and then pull them apart. And that's what you needed with the Capaldi. You needed those moments where he'd turn around and he'd just pull people apart. But they couldn't do that in the end because I think they were always trying to make Clara so strong. They kept making her the strong speech writer. So it would all be about her turning around and pulling him apart when he's being a dick. You think, no, he's an anti-hero. Let him be a dick and then turn around and pull other people apart, but in a way which is fun but not bullyish. There's that moment at the end of The Caretaker where she turns around and has a real go at him and then walks out and he's left speechless. And you're thinking, no, that character, that Capaldi character should never be speechless. He should be able to turn around and then that would have been the fun moment, have him turn around and pitch it against her in the way that House would pitch it, in Hugh Laurie's House, and turn around and pull her apart for her behaviour. How dare you speak to me like this? Who do you think you are? Do you know what I do? Do you know what I suffer? And you think this is all about you? You can really have him in a way which made the audience not feel it was bullish, not feel that it was devaluing her, but have him have a moment where he says, no, you take a step back. But they seem scared to do that with him. Is it because that would have made him seem a bully? I don't know. Can you? I mean, but you can have that sort of catharsis without people being bullies, but you've just got to set this. You've got to set the scene up to make sure that they don't come across. I think that's the difference. I don't know. I'm spitballing here.
No, that's fine, that's fine. That's possibly what we're here for. I don't know. I don't know. But you tell us what you think, dear listener. We are now on YouTube, if you want to listen to us on YouTube and stare at our chosen picture of the week. We're also on iTunes and Audio Boom. We're on Player FM. I think we might be on TuneIn Radio. You can find us in lots of different places. You can listen to us pretty much how you like. We're also at beyondcasterbus.com, and you can follow us on Twitter and communicate with us through that medium or through Facebook as well. That is pretty much all we've got time for in this week's podcast. With a K, we'll be back. Until next time, it's goodbye.